This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Could you leave civilization and survive? Really? Are we permanently plugged in? I'm Alex Smith. Welcome to A Mixed Bag of Greens this week. You'll hear Sri Lankan American author Ashoka Bandaraji's Solution for Collapse and a classic conversation from the Four Seasons Garden to your dinner table with one of America's best-known organic growers, Barbara Damrosch. But first, this from the Mother Earth News Fair.
No one is meant to be living here.
Hi, Terry Jacks, and you're listening to Radio EcoShock.
Too many people everywhere. I wish I was down there.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. Maybe something has triggered you that you would just like to run away from it all. It could happen in a commuter traffic jam. It could happen when your computer breaks down. Anything's possible. Have you ever felt like you'd like to leave it all? Would you like to walk away from civilization? Well, maybe you can. We're about to talk to somebody who has done it. Miles Olson is an author, he's a teacher, and he calls himself a professional dropout. He spent the last 10 years living in the woods of Vancouver Island in Canada on the West Coast. Miles Olson, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thanks for having me.
So, who were you before you left? Let's try and get a little bit of picture of Miles Olson.
Sure, good question. I was a teenager in high school before I left. I dropped out of high school when I was 17, and I guess I had been pretty disengaged from my studies for a couple of years, and I'd started cutting class to read books about edible plants and about ethnobotany and ethnology, and I'm not sure what exactly triggered. I think every teenage kid has dissatisfaction with the world they're in, typically. Teen angst, they call it. However it gets channeled is very unique in each individual. For me, for some reason, connecting to the land was where I went. I didn't start partying, doing drugs or anything. The land is where I went for my kind of fix on something that was more exciting than the drudgery of modern life. So, I read Thoreau and I spent probably a year fantasizing about doing what he did, building a little cabin and living in the woods and living simply and getting back to nature. And when I was 17, that's exactly what I did. I found out about a little abandoned cabin on an island called Morell Island, north of Vancouver Island, so very, very remote. Probably most of your listeners will have never heard of it. And there was, maybe a few people living on this island scattered about, and there's no hydro, no connection to the grid in any way. And I spent a summer living up there when I was 17. So that was my big jump out of the modern world, my big exodus into nature. That's where I had my first kind of revelations of who I was and what life is and what everything means, kind of alone in the wilderness. So I'm kind of answering your question a pretty roundabout way, but who I was when I walked away from civilization was just a teenage kid who had lived in an artificial, human-constructed reality for his whole life. And when I walked out into the wild, away from the human-constructed world, it was the worst thing that had ever happened to me. I completely regretted it. The minute I was dropped off on that island, I completely regretted ever going there. And there's probably a part of me that still regrets it, honestly.
Well, why do you say that? Why? What brought about the regret?
When I was a teenager, the person who I was before I took that plunge, I had a lot of ideals and fantasies about what living close to the land would be. You know, I think I thought I was just going out to live the good life, and I was going to be like some clumsy bear in a Disney cartoon eating berries by the stream or something. And, you know, kind of an absurd idea of life and nature. And as soon as I was dropped off on this island, I hired a water taxi to ferry me there an hour from the nearest town, and I got dropped off, and the minute that the roar of that engine faded away into the ocean and I couldn't see the boat anymore, I instantaneously realized what I had done. I had this sinking feeling in my gut, and I was, oh no, I'm alone. This is real. There's no escape. There's no escape from me. All that's here is me and this silent, foreboding world. And I didn't know anything about that. I hadn't experienced silence before. There was always a background noise of traffic or people or music or something. And being dropped alone as a 17-year-old kid, fresh out of that ridiculous teenage world into wild nature, was just a complete juxtaposition of realities. And the reason I regretted it is that there was a part of me that knew that it was going to die as soon as I got there. As soon as I was stuck there for several months. And I guess I didn't know anything about this as a teenager, but apparently every indigenous culture, most cultures throughout all human history, have had this institution in them called the initiation or the rite of passage, where members of the culture would go away from the village, away from mass consciousness, basically, and experience real reality away from the village, you know, in wild nature, which is a pure form of reality, not based on any human construct, not based on any human idea. It's just, it has roots far deeper than any of that. It transcends time. And that's the situation that I accidentally put myself into. And I never, ever would have wanted to do that as a 17-year-old kid.
So what happened then? I mean, you came back, you made some plans, you...
So the first month of that first experiment going out into the wilderness alone was complete hell. I was living in complete hell. There was things that I had to do. I brought only so much food, so I had to learn how to catch fish. I brought a fishing rod. I had to pick berries. I had to pick greens. I had to plant a little garden. I brought seeds. I had to haul water every morning. I had to gather firewood. There was these non-negotiable terms of existence that I just actually had to do. I had to have water. I had to have food. I had to start a fire to cook the food. So I had to do all these things. But the whole time I was just... There was a chatter in my mind the whole time that was just growing and growing and growing. And there was no other human around to spew that out and to reassure me of who I was and what reality was. And yeah, there was just this incessant dialogue in my head of, why don't you just get a job and a girlfriend and be a normal person? Why don't, you know, you're just putrefying out alone in the woods. This is pathetic. You're pathetic. This is basically all of my ugliness, all of my ego, all of my shadow, every little wound, every little crack floated up to the surface for me to taste and linger in my mouth. And that's part of that process of initiation. That's it's exactly what the kind of ancient institution of initiation is going away from the human reality and then going through a process of purging so that you can come back to the world knowing a deeper truth than you could know from the human world. And after a month of living in complete misery, all of a sudden one morning I remember sitting on the porch of the cabin eating breakfast, and I could hear the birds singing. And I realized, I'm hearing birds singing. I had never heard birds singing before. I really had never heard birds singing before. And that's because I had always had something else going on in my mind louder than that. And that might not sound that profound, and maybe it's not that profound, but gradually, that was kind of the beginning of a gradual process that by the end of being there for maybe 3 months, all of a sudden, I was really enjoying myself. Life was really beautiful. Everything was this beautiful, ecstatic experience. My mind had slowed down, and I was sleeping outside every night underneath the stars, and instead of feeling pathetic and lonely and thinking about all these things I didn't have, I was just present to the beauty of that. And I was picking berries and drying them in the sun on old screens I had found, and catching fish and eating them, and just really present to the beauty of life and the rhythms. And when I came back after that, I was out there for maybe 3.5 months, and when I came back to the city that I grew up in, I got dropped off on the east side of town. I remember walking through to my parents' house on the west side of town, and I had to walk through suburbs to get there, and just being in a suburban landscape after that itself was an incredible shock. And I wasn't politicized at that age. I didn't have any ideas about what suburbs were, if they're good or bad. I didn't care. They were just where people lived. And that's where I lived. And now, all of a sudden, it looked gross. Looked weird. There was something heinous about it. And the reason I say that if I knew what was going to happen, I probably wouldn't have gone, is because it just changed my perceptions. And they haven't changed back.
Well, I can see a couple of parallels. First of all, I went every summer to an island that I was fortunate enough. Our family owned an island in northern Ontario, and I spent every summer there. We had no power, no cars, no nothing. But I did have my family, and we had neighbors and so on. So it's not quite parallel. But that prepared me for when I went and dropped out and went back to the land in the late 1970s. 200 acres, no power again, lived for 10 years that way. But again, I was quite integrated with a society around me. So it is a different situation, certainly, than you experienced. And I know what you're talking about with the spirit quest, though, and that's important. And I did hear silence when I was out there, and that is something that very few people have heard.
Mm-hmm.
It's just amazing, you know. Yeah. In my case, it was with 8 feet of snow and no way out of the cabin. It's really, really quiet.
Yeah.
No planes overhead. You can't hear the highway. You couldn't even see any other houses from where I lived. So, you know, I kind of understand what you're talking about. Well, then, you've called yourself a professional dropout, though.
Someone else actually gave me that moniker.
Did they? So, what's the next stage?
So that's when I'm still a teenager when I came back from that island. And basically for the following 10 years, I've been, I guess, trying to integrate that experience into my life. I guess I never would think of that as a vision quest or something, but maybe that's a fair label for it. Maybe out of it, I got some call, some awakening that I felt like, yeah, I've needed to try and contextualize in my life. So for the last 10 years, basically, I've been living in a series of squats on the edge of a small city and learning how to hunt and gather, garden, scavenge, scrounge for my livelihood, and living communally with other people in what I call a feral homestead that we built, which has been fantastic. It's basically, we've proved to ourselves just the amount of freedom that you can really have if you just create it for yourself, if you create your own reality. Sounds kind of new agey almost now when I think about it, but what we did was we imagined something and then we created it. And the world never told us that that was an opportunity. When I was a teenager, my career classes never told me that, you know what, you could live for a decade without paying rent and you could live really well. And your life would almost be like going to university, but you write the curriculum because you can put all of that time and energy that you would have put into work into studying whatever you want. That's been how I've tried to contextualize all of that, is living intimate, learning, trying to learn how to live close to the land, as close as possible. And for the initial period, that was very rough. Because I grew up in the suburbs. I didn't even know how to split wood until I was 17. I didn't know how to start a fire until I had to. And so it was a slow, laborious, and ridiculous, and funny journey. And one of the reasons I wrote the book that I wrote was to offer some of the jewels that I feel like me and the community that I've been living with found through that journey.
And what's the title of the book?
The book is called Unlearn, Rewild: Earth Skills, Ideas, and Inspiration for the Future Primitive. So, Unlearn, Rewild, I guess, pretty much sums up my philosophy, which is that when I was talking about my journey as a 17-year-old into the woods, I was walking away from civilization, so I thought. I thought that I was walking away from all the problems of the world, and I would go into the woods to just be in that pure nature, and everything was going to be awesome. What I realized after getting there was that the problems of the world were in me. I was saturated with them. And when I walked into the woods, I brought them with me. Because it's like a contagious illness that we all carry. And so before we think about healing the planet or anything, there's a lot of stuff that we need to unlearn. It's a very intentionally titled book, Unlearn, Rewild. There are these two verbs that go together quite nicely. There's this basically spiritual or at the level of consciousness, there's this problem, this the root of our disconnect from ourselves and from the natural world. And yeah, without tackling that and dismantling that, we can't rewild, we can't fully integrate with the living world.
And you mentioned the bears, and I think we have a lot in common with the bears, actually.
Yeah.
I got to know some bears when we were living on our property. So do you think that we have this primitive still within us, always available? Is that always available to human race, or have we actually lost the primitive?
What do you mean by that, the primitive? Do you mean some kind of instinctual intelligence that's latent in us, like every other living thing?
Yes, I would say that, and also the capability to live without civilization. Can we really do that now?
That's a good question.
And maybe we'll have to. That's another question.
Yeah. My life over the last 10 years has not been in an extremely remote setting. Like I said, I've been living on the edge of a city in a series of squats. So I live on the edge of wildness and civilization, and I kind of like that. I like being able to dance between both worlds. I like being able to feed off both worlds. I live a very unconventional life. I don't have a job. I don't have a car. I don't have electricity. I don't have running water.
Have you got a visa?
No.
Okay.
But I do have an email account, and I do have a bicycle and, you know, things that are not completely primitive. The question of can we walk away completely from civilization, that's not really my area of interest. To walk away physically from civilization and just try and subsist completely off the wild, while I think that's valuable for experimentation and for revelation and for experience and fun, the real problem of our oppressive culture is at a deeper level than superficial. There's trappers who live on trap lines and beat up their kids and beat up their wives and live a subsistence lifestyle on the land. But they've got that sickness that is this culture's sickness. And it transcends form and space and where you are and how you live. Now, connecting to the land is one of the best ways to get rid of that programming, that artificial voice and all that oppressive behavior. But in itself, it is just a superficial act that might not necessarily have healing as part of it.
I almost picture it like you can never really leave the stage. We're actors. You can think that you're leaving the stage. And I also picture you when you're packing up your supplies, you're going to head off, you're 17, or maybe you're 32, you're going to leave civilization. You do put in that backpack all these problems that we haven't examined about ourselves and the voices that you talk about that I'm familiar with that are latent in us that are just started when we were little kids growing up in this civilization. Mm-hmm. For my generation, an older generation, it was the fear of the atomic bomb. I mean, that was just drilled into us. And I used to imagine running away and surviving somehow when I was 6 and 8 years old. And I know I'm not alone. There's a lot of people. And today I think there's a fantasy that we'll solve the problems of civilization when civilization collapses.
Yeah.
And then everything will be good.
Yeah. I talk about that in my book. And as an idealistic young squatter living close to land and basically learning how to survive without civilization, because we learned, and all these skills are in my book. My book is kind of a philosophical exploration and a collection of skills that I feel like are the most interesting and unique that I learned over 10 years living as a squatter on the land. We learned how to hunt, how to preserve all of our own food without industrial technology, how to tan hides and make clothing out of them, how to start fires without, you know, by friction, how to make bows and arrows and, you know, a lot of Stone Age skills that are awesome and fantastic skills to learn for connecting to the land. And we had kind of an idea that civilization is going to collapse and we're going to walk through the ashes of it. But at some point, we came to this realization, or at least I came to the realization that, wait a minute, what's driving this culture? We tend to think of it as a mechanical problem, the problem of sustainability. We're thinking, oh, we're burning too much fossil fuels, we need to burn less fossil fuels, and that will solve the problem. Or, oh, we have too many plastic bags, we need to have less plastic bags, and we've solved that problem. But the first culture that we would call a civilization that sprang up 6,000 years ago in what's presently Iraq, they developed farming for the first time. They were hunter-gatherers that started cultivating wheat from the floodplains. They started cutting down the forests where they lived. There were massive forests of cedar and cypress, not unlike the forests in the northwest here. They started cutting down those forests and planting grain where the forests had been. They learned that you could do that with these annual grains, and they kept on doing that, and they learned how to divert the river so that they could irrigate these crops because they weren't in a floodplain anymore. And after several centuries, they had turned these forests into deserts. And it's really interesting because they did that all with organic farming and stone and bone tools, which suggests to me that the problem... It's interesting to note that that level of technology is the same as the level of technology that was here on the Northwest Coast, and yet the people here didn't destroy their land base. And that suggests to me that the problem isn't necessarily a technical one. It's not necessarily a mechanical one. It has a deeper root, because the only difference between the people here and the people there was what was in their mind, basically the way that they saw the land and the way that they interacted with it. It was a different... They had a different program.
Certainly. Different the idea of domination was in there.
Yeah.
And as soon as agriculture sprang up, so did wars. Continual wars.
Well, as soon as you start treating the land in an oppressive way, you start treating life in an oppressive way.
And women.
They're alive too. Women, men, children.
Yeah.
All of a sudden, all of these oppressive things come into the picture when you start oppressing anything. It's just, there's no duality, really, when you look at cultures that way.
And then, now I'm going to ask the impossible. Did you come up with some answers to this problem?
Yeah, I'll finish the last question that you asked, and then I'll go to this one. And what I was going to say is relating that to collapse, because people have this idea that if civilization collapsed, well, that might be a solution to these problems, because it doesn't seem to be slowing down on its own. But if the root of our problem is the stories that we're carrying and the programming in our minds and in our hearts, then if this culture falls, that problem has not been touched. And you haven't dealt with the problem of 7 billion crazy humans, which I would suggest is rather significant.
It's one big asylum at times. Okay.
But to tie that into your other question, if you frame the problem as we have all this stuff that we need to unlearn, it makes it much more complex, kind of. We won't just have the revolution today and the new world tomorrow. That's not going to happen if we all need to basically become whole people, if we need to all heal and reintegrate with ourselves and with the land and start having healthy, non-oppressive relationships. That's a very subtle, nuanced thing. And yet, I think it's actually far more realistic of an approach. And it's well known that insanity is contagious, I would say. That's a very unscientific statement. But everyone knows that abusive behavior begets abusive behavior. Someone who has been sexually abused in their childhood is very likely in adulthood to go on and repeat that behavior if they don't somehow heal from that. And that's just kind of how abuse is contagious, right? Our whole culture is built on that contagion. And I have a theory that sanity might be contagious as well. That whatever the dark, destructive element that has got everyone under its spell spreads, perhaps that's how another lighter element works. That's the only solution I have.
Well, there could be a wave of sanity. I could picture it. Other than that, we're left to alien intervention or magic mushrooms, you know. I mean, it's a tough problem. Well, we're starting to run out of time here. Miles Olson, it's been a fascinating talk. I'm going to ask you to tell us the title of your book again, because I'm going to have to read it, I think.
My book is Unlearn, Rewild, Earth Skills, Ideas, and Inspiration for the Future Primitive. And it's highly philosophical and highly practical. If you want to, if you just want to connect to the land in a deeper way, if you want to think about your relationships with humans and with the earth in a deeper way, then I highly recommend it.
Okay, and we can find out more at milesolson.net. And I'm not ready to walk away from civilization, but I sure am ready for it to change in a big way. I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock. Stay tuned for our talk with Barbara Damrosch at the Mother Earth News Fair. But first, you know, our environment, species, climate, and economy are flirting with collapse. It's global, and it needs global eyes. Last week we played a reading by Ashoka Bandaraji. Now it's time to speak with her. Is it possible we could be organic, solar-powered humans and still destroy the ecology of the world? is there an inner destructive force we need to examine and change in order to evolve or perhaps even to survive? I'm Alex Smith, host of Radio EcoShock. Ashoka Bandaraji is the author of the new book, Sustainability and Well-Being, The Middle Path to Environment, Society, and the Economy, published by Palgrave Macmillan. Ashoka Bandaraji is a Yale PhD. She's the author of numerous publications in the field of global political economy, environment, population, and women's studies. She's a college professor and has taught at Brandeis, Mount Holyoke, Georgetown, American, and other universities. Our guest takes us from the early stages of collapse into a different path, the middle path. Ashoka, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you very much for having me on your show.
Well, I said the early stages of collapse because for most of us, maybe except for the billion peoples living in extreme poverty, real collapse has not yet come. Would you agree?
Yes, I would agree because, you know, we are still believing that the status quo can continue and that we can succeed within the established institutions and the worldview.
And what systems do you think, though, are approaching collapse?
Well, certainly the environment, you know, there's all this data on climate change and global warming and its impact on communities across the world and the increasing numbers of environmental refugees, people who have been displaced due to disasters associated with climate change. There's also biodiversity loss that is rampant, and then chemical pollution. And I think that in the industrialized North, people are not so aware of the acuteness of these crises in many other parts of the world. For example, the use of chemical pesticides in agriculture and how that's leading to chronic kidney disease and other health problems in agricultural communities, for example.
Well, I would add to your list also the economy because the banking crisis and the way the high unemployment, there's a lot of problems there too. Well, now we have a system of giant banks and corporations and military organizations that seem to be taking us outside the planet's ability to support us, and yet these same institutions insist they are the only way. How would you describe this mode of thinking?
I think that the dominant worldview is that we can create a reality that is a market-based and technology-based reality which sees humanity and the natural environment as resources to be used and almost as dispensable entities, when in fact we need to see things from an ecological perspective where we as human beings and certainly the economic system, which is a subsystem of a society, are embedded within this larger reality of the ecosystem and the environment. And we need to take an ecological perspective rather than this sort of mechanistic and market-based perspective, which is dominating and increasingly becoming the dominant approach to life. So much so that, you know, we are talking about bioengineering, biotechnology, creating new species, transhuman species, that is merging humans with machines and life as created in laboratories, you know, not just plants and animals, but increasingly human life itself. And that, of course, is the extreme, but that is the direction in which we are moving.
Radio EcoShock will be right back with more from Ashoka Bandaraji, author of Sustainability and Well-Being, plus the queen of organic growers, Barbara Damrosch of Four Season Farm.